listen to Shoot the Defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to Shoot the Defence, brought to you by the FNX Network and My Sportswear. I'm your host, Stel, and joining me this evening is Mike Perry. Welcome back, Mike.
Hello, Stel. How are you?
Fine, thanks, yourself?
Good, good.
Excellent. Now, our guest is a gentleman whose personality, charisma, achievements and no-nonsense attitude makes him a legend in the game. Shoot the Defence is proud to bring to you Bobby Gould, a.k.a. the Gould Father. Bobby, welcome to Shoot the Defence. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Stella. It's nice to speak to you after all this time we've been organising it.
Absolutely. It's an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
Well, Bobby, there is a really nice story about your trial at Coventry City, which earned you Jimmy Hill's respect immediately. Can you tell us about it?
I was a youngster at Coventry City. I played under a manager called Billy Fripp. Mm-hmm. Who gave me an 8-week trial, and after that 8-week trial, he said, "No, I'm sorry, you're not good enough," and I left the football club. I was able to join a company called Daly and Sons, and they were a heating and ventilating company. I went there and signed on for a year's apprenticeship, and within a few weeks and months, Coventry City had gone through a rough period, and Billy Fripp got the sack, and a certain gentleman came from London called Jimmy Hill, and Mr. Derek Robbins, who was the chairman of Coventry City at the time, appointed Jimmy Hill as the manager. He invited all the local youngsters who failed at Coventry City for trials, and I was one of them, and I had a trial on a Sunday morning, and Jimmy Hill said, "We'd like you to come back this afternoon." I said, I'm sorry, JH, but I'm doing something." So he said, "Will you come back next Sunday morning?" I said, "Yeah, of course I will." So the week passed. I went back, played well again in this trial game on the Sunday morning, and Jimmy Hill came up and said to me, "We'd like to sign you as one of our apprentice professionals." I said, "That would be fantastic." But I said to him, "You are aware that they've just recently sacked me from this football club?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "But this decision is mine now." And he said, "But before you sign," he says, "you've got to answer me the first question I'd like to ask you." I says, "What's that?" He says, "Why didn't you come back last Sunday afternoon?" I said, "Mr. Hill, the circumstances were that my father is in Coventry Warwickshire Hospital. He's losing his eyesight. And you or nobody else, Mr. Hill, is going to stop me from seeing him because I work 5.5 days a week. I then play football on Saturday afternoon, and the only time I could get to see my dad is on a Sunday afternoon." And he just looked at me, he smiled and he winked, and I said, "Thank you very much." And after that, we just had a perfect relationship.
Nice, very nice.
Bobby, great to speak to you. Yourself and Jimmy Hill are both synonymous and legends at Coventry City, and he led an incredible life and did so much for the game of football. Doing my research, you once said that Jimmy Hill as a manager was, and I quote, "as good as Cluffy, as good as Shankly, as good as Steen. He was up there and he knew it, and we played for that," end quote. Now, that is some statement to make. What are your favourite recollections of Jimmy Hill?
The favourite one is we were playing top of the table clash, it was, against Ipswich on a Friday night. And he was well aware that we were under a lot of pressure and we got to win the game. But recently, it just put these scoreboards up and it recognised the goal scorer. It didn't put your name on the scoreboard. It just put your number up. And prior to the game, quarter to seven, he walks into the dressing room, walks straight up to me. And I have the number 9 shirt on. He says, "Young man," he says, "you're going to score a hat-trick tonight." So all of that, he just turned tail, didn't speak to anybody else, and turned tail and walked out the dressing room, and all the senior professionals and like, I was a babe in arms, really, 19, 20, and they all started taking the mickey out of me. And anyway, so we went out, we started the first half, and all of a sudden, after 33 minutes, on this scoreboard at the back of the goal, the Swan Lane end, there was three numbers, and it went 9, 9, 9. And I just looked and I thought, I can't believe that. That manager, J.H., just came in, said to me before the game, you're going to score a hat-trick. And there I was, I've got this hat-trick, 3-0 up against Ipswich. And I looked across to the stand, because he wasn't, he never went in the dugout. J.H. never went in the dugout, and he was in a situation where he was sitting up in the stand and in the director's box. And I looked across to him, and I just thought, you are God. And that was, you know, that was the Coventry City. And, you know, I'm actually all those great managers, but Jimmy Hill, he had this wonderful ability to give you great confidence, and that's what he fed the Coventry City players on, confidence, and we were successful with him.
Well, Bobby, you had a couple of confrontations with Jimmy Hill about wages. The first one earned you about 50p extra, but the next didn't go to plan. Now, these days, the top goal scorer at a promotion-winning club would probably get pretty much what they wanted, but what happened when you asked for a raise?
Well, I was on about £12 a week, you know. I was leading goal scorer, and he said to me, he said, what are you doing in my office? I said, well, J.H., I said, I've just got promotion with you and into the first team. And he said to me, he said, well, what do you want? I said, I want £30 a week. And he laughed. He just laughed, blatantly laughed in my face. And I was just getting married as well. And I thought, well, I need more money than I've been surviving on. And he just laughed. He said, just dismiss yourself. Go out. Just go out and come back with a realistic answer in the next few days and everything else. Well, you go home, and as a youngster like that, you know, I hadn't gained much experience. We didn't have anybody to talk to, really, of the professional rank. So I went home, I looked in the evening paper, the Coventry Evening Telegraph, and no news whatsoever. That was the first night, second night, third night. By the fourth day, I'm panicking a little bit. You know, there's been nothing in the paper. Is he going to transfer list me or anything? Anyway, so I went back into the office and I said, J.H., I said, there's no news in the paper. He says, no. Who wants to know about you? Nobody wants to know about you. So anyway, I said, you're going to make me an offer? He says, yeah. He says, I'll offer you about £26, £25. I said, I'll take it, J.H., I'll take it. And that's the way he was. He was a great controller of people, and you know. But at the, you know, he knew what he thought my worth was, and that was it.
Mm. Well, a move to Arsenal followed. Although you then signed for not one but two of Coventry's local rivals, that being Wolves and West Brom. Now, you posted a photograph of yourself in the Wolves kit on Twitter the other day, and Richard Keys responded by calling you a Judas. Did you get much stick over both transfers?
Well, I was a professional footballer, and the only way I was going to make a living was by scoring goals. And if I made a living, then you have to go to the right club. And I always believed in my own ability to score goals. And along the way, if you're having a rough time, and I had a bit of a rough time, I went to Arsenal, and I went to Wolverhampton Wanderers, and I scored 25 goals in 50 games. And I went to West Brom to play alongside Jeff Vastel. Unfortunately, I didn't play the amount of games alongside him because he got injured. And I believe that if I'd live off the knockdowns in the six-yard area, and that was me. And if one manager didn't want me, I wasn't going to play in the reserves. I went because I believed I could score goals. And I think in the end, my career figures stand that up to this day.
Absolutely.
Bobby, when Don Howe took you to the Hawthorns, he partnered you with club legend Jeff Astle up front. What do you remember about Jeff?
Jeff Astle was one of the funniest people in the game I ever came across. I met funny in a lovely way, you know, this great sense of humour. And his sidekick was Tony Brown, and who was a wonderful goal scorer, a great player for the Baggies, and they had a wonderful relationship. Anyway, so we were at a period in the game where the referees and the linesmen used to come in and inspect all your footwear and everything else because they didn't want any danger with the plastic studs. And if there was a sharp edge, that you have to take the stud out and replace it with another one to make sure that you weren't going to do any damage to anybody. Anyway, Jeff Astle had this role where the linesman would come in, he'd stand, he'd show the linesman or the referee his right boot. And as he placed it down, he was facing the linesman or the referee. He then turned round and brought the same boot up, and the linesman and the referee didn't realise they were still examining his right foot. And because the rest of the players, we were in stitches, and he did it week in, week out, and not one referee or one linesman fell for it. And they must have gone out the dressing room and thinking, what's going on in there? But we were laughing at their lack of their preparation of deciding that they hadn't looked at Jeff Astle's left boot. But that was the fun of the dressing room as well, you know. If you looked at good clubs, they've always got happy dressing rooms.
That's right. So, sandwiched in between spells at Bristol City and Bristol Rovers, you picked up an FA Cup winner's medal with West Ham in 75 and was part of the second division title winning Wolves side. Now, when you look back on your playing career, what is your proudest moment?
My proudest moment was against Swindon when we were about 2 minutes from the end of the game. We'd been playing at Wembley and the pitch was awful. It had had the Horse of the Year show, and it damaged a lot of the drains, and the water didn't flow away, and it was a nightmare, really. And we were 1-0 down to Swindon with 2 minutes through, and George Graham knocked a long ball into the attacking third of Swindon. I chased after it. A young goalkeeper called Downsborough came out. He kicked the ball against me, and it ricocheted into the air. And then all of a sudden, all I can see is I'm watching a football drop at the south goal of Wembley, and I know there's nobody on the goal line, and I know if I can just head that ball, make contact with it, I was going to score at Wembley, which is a dream for any professional footballer. The ball dropped down, and I just knocked it into an empty net, and on the way there towards it, Frank Burrows, a centre-back for Swindon, kicked me in the throat in the Adam's apple. The ball's gone into the back of the net. I've run behind the goal towards where all the Arsenal supporters were, and I just burst in tears, and everybody thought, oh, he's got so emotional, and it wasn't actually that. I got kicked in the Adam's apple, and there I was, in pain, but having scored a goal at Wembley, and that's the dream of any professional footballer, and I've achieved it.
Excellent, superb. Bobby, some of the roommates you've had during your career, people, if I'm right in saying, George Curtis, Bob Wilson at Arsenal, Mike Bailey at Wolves, Bomber Brown at West Bromwich Albion, and obviously Trevor Brooking at West Ham. I mean, they're big names. They're, you know, they're important names in the history of football. What was it about them that stood out from the rest in terms of best roommates that you had?
It was something you built up as a relationship on your way. You know, you had common denominators. The common denominator with Trevor Brooking was that in 1973, when I signed for West Ham from Bristol City, I used to have to commute from Portishead, even where I live now, a little village on the Severn Estuary, and I used to have to commute because the house market fell apart in about 1973, and we couldn't sell our house to move up to London. So I used to travel up daily, and the lads felt sorry for me. Trevor Brooking also felt sorry for me, and he used to pick me up at the tube station and take me to the training ground. And you just built up these relationships as you go along. George Curtis at Coventry City, he put me under his wing because he felt sorry for me, and I was a youngster coming through, and he just gave me the inner strength and knowledge of the game. And it's just wonderful when you look back over your own career, what players and how players handled you and how you handled those players.
And British coaches plying their trade in Scandinavia back in the 70s were few and far between. Now, how did the move to Norway come about, and what did you notice about the player mentality out there compared to here?
West Ham won the FA Cup against Fulham 2-0. Alan Taylor, nicknamed Sparrow, gets two goals. And we go over to Norway for pre-season training with John Lyle, who was the manager, and Ron Greenwood. And we went to a place called Ullesund, which is in northern Norway. And it's a wonderful, wonderful city and town and everything. And I was in a situation where I was coming towards the latter stages of my career. And I went into coaching, took my coaching badges, just like Wayne Rooney is now. And I wanted to be a coach or was it a manager? And I spoke to the chairman of Ullerton and I said, what are you looking for? He said, well, we want somebody to coach us. And I said, well, I'm coming towards the latter stages of my career. I'll come back over next season and in the summer and work for you. And that's what I did. And what it taught me, Mike, was I was in a position of, was I a coach or was I a manager? And there's two different roles here. Like you used to see Brian Clough, and he was a manager, and then Don Howe was always a coach. And I wanted to find where I stood. And I went over to Ullerton, and I took my family over there 2 years running. And at the end of that period, I realised that I was going to be a manager. And wherever I went, I was looking for a coach who was always going to be a better coach than I was at that period. And that's what I developed with the Norwegian lads. They were brilliant to me. The AFK, their abbreviation and it was Ullerton. And my family and my boys and my wife, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And there's a period of lifetime that we benefited from, and we all learned from it as well.
Fantastic.
Bobby, when you were sacked from Coventry, you actually signed the majority of the 1987 Coventry side that won the FA Cup. Such is football, I guess. Do you have any regrets that you were not part of that occasion?
No, not really, because I'd actually failed, with the club. And there was a chairman called John Poynton who lived in Jersey, and he took over the football club, and he came to me over and said, look, we can't be at the bottom of the table. And I said, well, you've got to make a decision. We lost to Luton 5-1 on Boxing Day, and I was in a position of saying to the chairman, if you want to sack me, come over and speak to my lawyer. So he was in a position of saying, no, well, I live in Jersey. So I said, well, I'll leave that up to you. And anyway, so 24 hours later, and I could see I was getting all under pressure and uptight. I'd got to go in and see the chairman the next day, and how was I going to handle it? Well, the chairman arrived. I went to Highfield Road. I went in to see the chairman, and as I walked in, I had the car keys in my hand, and I said, I threw the car keys onto the desk. I said, you've hurt me so much, and I'm so disappointed that I've lost this job. You can stick your job and your car up your backside. But I turned tail and I walked out, and what I didn't realise was that I'd given them my car keys, and I was still living in Bristol. And I thought, well, how the hell are you going to get back now? Anyway, I had a mate called Bill Smith who lived in Kenilworth, and I phoned him. I said, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm up a ladder building a house. I said, no, you're not. I said, get in your car, drive to Highfield Road, pick me up, you're taking me back home. I said, they've just sacked me. So that, if any of you two ever go into an office and somebody's going to sack you, never take your car keys.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Okay,
thanks for the tip.
Just learn from one of my mistakes. But I made a few mistakes, but along the way, playing-wise and football-wise, I had a fantastic career.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Bobby, your first full managerial position, or your first full-time managerial position, was at Bristol Rovers, a club you knew very well. But it was at Wimbledon where the magic happened. Now, I assume you knew London quite well from your time at Arsenal, West Ham and Chelsea, but what was it about Wimbledon that made you want to manage them?
They were in the First Division. I'd actually played there. Not many people know this, but I actually played there. Jeff Hurst, who went on FA courses, and we were fast-tracked through, and Jeff Hurst said to me, he said, if I ever get a job, I will give you the number two position. So this happened, and I went to Chelsea in 1979 with Jeff Hurst, and unfortunately 2 years later we'd missed out on promotion from the second division to the first division. And he went into the boardroom one day and he came out. I said, what do you say to the board? He said, I asked them to back us or sack us, Goldie. He said, they sacked us, all right, Goldie. So I got the sack, Jeff Hersey got the sack, but I was in a position of living in Camberley, and Dave Bassett was the manager of Wimbledon, and I was away in Spain, and I was reading the Daily Express, and I saw he wanted an experienced centre forward, so I phoned Dave Bassett up at Wimbledon. I said, "Dave, I says I've found a centre forward for you." He said, "Who's that?" I said, "It's me." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'm 36." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I've just been sacked." I said, "I live at Camberley, and I'd like to come and train with you and see you could see if you fancy me." Anyway, it all materialised. I trained at Wimbledon, and I had a wonderful 6-week period. After that, I went to. I didn't go anywhere. Dave didn't want to sign me, and I was getting an offer from Aldershot to go and be the assistant manager to Lenny Walker down there, and I went down to be assistant manager to Aldershot, and then I got the opportunity to go to Bristol Rovers, and I went to Bristol Rovers, and I just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And then later on, Wimbledon came for me. I knew most of the lads, and I had an understanding, you know, what Dave Bassett was doing there was something very, very different, and it was long ball football, and I decided I knew the heart of the football club, and that's when I went there as manager in 1986, and I asked Don Howe to come and help me because he lost his job with England, and we just got together, and we went to Sweden on our first trip, and we stood up in front of the flip chart and we said we were going to tell the players of Wimbledon what we wanted. And they said, "No, you've got it all wrong. This is the way we play. We get the ball into the attacking third 172 times in 90 minutes and we get 40 ball crosses in with Carlton Fairweather and Dennis Wise. And if they don't get 40 ball crosses in, then they're going to be on Sunday morning for extra training." So if it wasn't broken, why fix it? And Don Howe and I looked at each other, and that's the road we went down. And the lads responded, and they were truly, truly brilliant. But it was all because I'd been there before as a player, and that laid the foundation for me, and it gave us all the success. And people used to say, "What's it like managing Wimbledon?" I said, "It's like going to the worst comprehensive school in Great Britain." Because you had to make sure that all these players turned up, and they were great lads, but you know, we had to make sure that we turned them into to good professionals. And that actual team that won the FA Cup was sold for £13 million. £13 million, and not many people realised that. And that's how the Wimbledon episode came about for the Gould family.
Brilliant.
Amazing, brilliant. I mean, the crazy gang, as they were known, obviously, which preceded you and followed you, part of English football folklore, Bobby, and there must be hundreds of stories. But one that I found, you know, researching today was when you got a broken rib courtesy of Dennis Wise after you both donned a pair of boxing gloves and had a fight with each other. Can you tell our listeners how this came about? Are there any other crazy gang stories you want to share? Your favourites, maybe?
Well, I was well aware of, like, the scenarios of the circle, and I went back as the manager, and Dennis Wise, like, I loved him, you know, he was the smallest man in the club, but what a big heart he had. And anyway, I said, "Do they still do the circle?" "Of course we could do, Gordy, you know that." Anyway, on the first session, there was a lad, young lad called Vaughan Ryan, and he wasn't pleasing me with his attitude, whether he was sulking because Dave Bassett had gone, I don't know. And I said to him, "You're not pulling your weight, Vaughan." I said, "It's about time you started pulling your weight." And Dennis Wise shouted, "Circle, circle." So then all the professionals in the club get together, formed a circle, and they were in a situation where they came into the circle, and then there was just me and Vaughan. We would grapple. There was no punching, no pinching. We were just grappling, and all of a sudden we get we get through to each other that you know we weren't bad for each other. We were good for each other. So anyway, Vaughan Ryan didn't want to participate, and Dennis Wise said, "This is what you do, Vaughan." So Wise, he jumped on me, and we were grappling like there was no tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, I fell on my rib, and as I fell on my rib, it was on my fist, and I felt my rib going. I said to the physio, Steve, I said, "Steve, get me out of here quick," I said, "because I don't want that lot to know that I'm in pain. So Steve physio, walked me all the way up, and yeah, I had cracked a rib as well. And once the lads found that out, they couldn't stop laughing, but that was the circle, and we were well aware of it. And by the way, I actually took on John Hartson down at in the when I was Welsh manager, and that was another story. But it was all good fun. It was all in the interest of getting the best out of my players, and that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Fast forwarding then to the 1988 Cup final, and that must surely rank as among the highlights of your managerial career. So much has been written and said about that game, but there are three stories I'd like you to elaborate on, if indeed they are true. First one is, did you really slip the Wembley groundsman a few quid to get an extra training session on the pitch?
No, there was an envelope that was left in somebody's office and somebody forgot to pick it up.
Ah, right, OK. Second one, did you really put the clock in Liverpool's changing room 2 minutes back so they would have to wait for your team in the tunnel?
That was Don Howe.
And
we walked in and Don said, right, everybody put your clocks back 2 minutes.
Excellent.
And I looked at him and everybody looked at him and every clock, even the one on the dressing room, went back 2 minutes. And every time that the referee or linesman came to the door, they looked at us and we looked at them and they said, what do you want? He said, well, you're supposed to be out. No. We've got the charts here. We've got the little booklet that gives us the time. And look at the time there. You're two minutes in front. You've got to wait for us. So I think we annoyed Mr. Dalglish a little bit that we kept him waiting.
And whose idea was it to have Wise and Cork take Aldridge-style penalties at Dave Besson on the eve of the Cup final?
It was on the Friday night, and they knew that a certain Liverpool player would put the ball down, run up, check, and side-foot it, run up, check, side-foot it, run up, check, side-foot it. And they practised that on with Dave Besson in goal. And lo and behold, you get a penalty given against you, you're 1-0 up, and Dave Besson actually does exactly the same, the penalty table for Liverpool, runs up, checks, side puts it, goes to the goalkeeper's left, and there's Big Lurch, is his nickname, diving to his left and makes a save. And that was the professionalism of Wimbledon. People underestimated, and John Aldridge, he goes to his knees, but what he doesn't realise is what those lads have been doing on the Friday afternoon. And lo and behold, Dave Besson was one that saves a penalty, and I upset Laurie Sanchez as well that day, because the goal scorers usually get the football, but as Dave Besson made the first penalty save in an FA Cup final, I gave the ball to Dave Besson, and Laurie Sanchez has never forgiven me.
Okay. Well, we can ask you, do you think Liverpool took Wimbledon too lightly that day, because they were a great team, great players, or was it just a case of you were just, you know, you're just better on the day, took your chance, had the penalty save, and you deserved it?
No, Don Howe was brilliant. He'd been to a luncheon on the Thursday, and he'd come back on the Thursday at lunchtime, and we were training Thursday lunchtime and Friday afternoon to prepare for the afternoon kickoff against Liverpool. And so we acclimatised ourselves. And Don came back on a Thursday and said, Gordy, he said, we've got to change it to wingers, because we had Alan Court wide left, Dennis Wise wide right. And we knew there was a certain winger for Liverpool that had been unbelievable. He'd had the greatest season of all seasons. So we were in a position of saying, right, well, we'll put Dennis Wise the other side and make Alan Court go on the left-hand side, because Wise was playing left. So we changed it. And all of a sudden, like in the second half, a certain gentleman that had been player of the year for Liverpool and the country never, ever got a kick. He was sandwiched. We got Dennis Wise to come in front of him. We got Clive Goodyear to be at the back of him. And it was just work like poetry. And it's all down to Don Howe, really. Mm. And that wonderful player of Liverpool never, ever got a kick.
Mm. Terry Gibson, one of your former players, in his autobiography, talks about a tale when you asked a squad to ensure they had their passports in order because you were planning a mid-season trip, and they all thought they were going somewhere like Spain, but you took them to a wet and windy Buckinghamshire. Now, the lads weren't that impressed, and Gibson recalls your fury the morning after as you went ballistic. Can you tell our listeners what happened and why is it we don't hear it, these sorts of stories anymore?
We had a bright, intelligent lad, you know, streetwise and everything else. But from a football point of view, we had to educate them. Don Howe and I had to educate them. There's so many stories out there. This is one that I've forgotten about. the memory goes so far back. But Gibbo was a great little centre forward. Played off the big man. I signed him for Coventry from Spurs, and Gibbo was a very, very special player. But people don't realise neither that I had another story when I wanted to buy him. I went to Sam O'Man and I said $250,000, and Sam O'Man says, "No, I'm not paying that much." He says, "The only way you can do that," he says, "I'll take you out to dinner tonight." So Sam O'Man took me out in London and said, "Right, if you want Terry Gibson, you've got to eat 12 sheep's testicles." So we went into the restaurant, and the 12 testicles, sheep's testicles, were presented to me. And I soaked them in vinegar, and it's the only way I got through. And once I ate the 12 testicles, he wrote a cheque for £250,000. He says, "Go and buy Terry Gibson."
Did Terry Gibson know about that?
I think Gibbo and I were to be great friends after that. But I tell you what, I'm glad I had that vinegar on the table.
Brilliant story, brilliant.
Bobby, while winning the FA Cup at Wimbledon is probably your greatest achievement as manager, would it be fair to say that your biggest regret was ignoring Don Howe's advice and accepting the West Brom job?
I suppose so. I wanted to be a number one again. I'd come out of Wimbledon and had a 6 month standing away from the game, and then Don went to QPR and I went as his number two. And West Ham came hunting for me, and Don said, don't go. And I went, and unfortunately it wasn't the right club for me at the right time. And Don went to other pastures, and I was at West Brom, and I failed. And it's a disappointment, but as a human being, we all make mistakes in our life. And the West Brom was a mistake. I learned from it, and I became a better manager the second time around at Comedy City in 1992.
Mm. So, why do you think the local press targeted you? Was it simply because they wanted Stuart Pearson to take charge?
No, I just think they had a young whippersnapper in there that was trying to live off me, and I challenged him on numerous occasions, and I just felt it wasn't right that he was putting me under pressure. So I stood up for my rights, and sometimes you have to back down, or sometimes you have to make sure that you're going to stand your own corner, and I always stood my own corner if it was needed.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about Sir Alex Ferguson, because I read somewhere that you and him aren't the best of friends. And apparently an incident between John Fashanu and Viv Anderson lit the fuse. Then something about Ryan Giggs' international friendly agenda and the media threw petrol on the fire. What do you remember about both incidents?
I can remember them like yesterday. But the circumstances are, there's certain incidents in your life where you just have to pass over. The stories there are there, and incidents happen. But sometimes, you know, you have to say, "I'm sorry, but that's one area I didn't want to go into, really." And Sir Alex and I, we crossed swords. I was never comfortable when he was in the dugout, and he was never comfortable. He was never comfortable when I was in the dugout. And I just wanted to win football games, no more, no less than Sir Alex, really. There was an incident, there was situations in the dressing room. It was accepted in the right spirit in our dressing room, but he didn't accept it in his, and therefore we did cross swords in the dressing room, but we all went our different ways, and those stories are there. People interpretate them the way they want to interpretate them, but that's one I wouldn't want to go down, lads. Thank you.
No problem. So on to Don Howe. I mean, tell us about your relationship with him and how much he gave to English football, because people don't actually realise the influence that he had over the English game.
Don Howe was a thorough coach, as I explained about my own experience in Norway. Don went to West Brom when I was there, and it wasn't good for Don. He didn't have a good period there neither. And he knew he was a coach, and and you identify that. And in the latter stages of your career or your livelihood in football, you know what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. And we exposed each other. And I went to watch Warren Barton play in a non-league game, and I took Don with me. And after 20 minutes, Don says, I can't see anything, Bob. I can't see anything in the right back. I said, well, you get in the car, Don, and drive home. And he went home, and I sat the game out, watched Warren Barton. I went to Sam McMahon. I said, I found another right back, and I'd like to sign him. And that was Warren Barton. He came to Wimbledon, and I left 3 days later. But what Warren was so pleased about was that he went to play under Don Howe, and and Don Howe made him a better player. And these are the things that happen, and Don had that ability to coach players, and he loved it. That was where he was at his best. And I was at my best when I was looking for young and up-and-coming players. And if you look back over my track record, Stuart Pearce from Royal Stone, he's a star of the lot of them. But there was a lot of other youngsters that I gave the opportunity to. And like Don and myself, we knew where our grounds were, and we respected that.
Absolutely. So on to Wales, and your stint as head coach was eventful, to say the least. Now, you said at one point, I was likely to be the one to put my head in the lion's mouth and end some great careers, referring to Mark Hughes and Ian Rush. Now, did you feel said players were holding back the next crop of Welsh talent from breaking into the national team?
Not really. I think they were all coming towards the end of their careers, really, and I was asked to move them on, and that was never going to be easy, with the disciplining situation and players having never had their careers with Wales, etc. And it was a time in my life where I look back now over the history of it, and it's the same with Sam Allardyce as well. You have to understand that you never played at international level. And I never played at international level. Sam Allardyce never played at international level. And I think that if he's going to be successful, Sam, and I think he's taking Sammy Lee with him as well, that Sammy Lee will be able to help Sam Allardyce. I didn't have anybody in that category that I wanted alongside me that had been an international. And that's where I came unstuck. I've got a lot of passion. I've got a lot of commitment. But the players, when they play for their country, remember, they've been working and playing for their own clubs, and then all of a sudden they come down to an international get-together that they are physically and mentally very, very tired. And you have to give them that opportunity to unwind. And I never did that. And I was chasing their tail. I wanted to do this, wanted to do that. And it was the wrong thing to do. What I should have done was let them relax, let them unwind, and then go through the scenarios of pattern of play, dead ball situations, and then just rely on their footballing ability and pick the right 11 and get the right balance and blend. Like there's three of us in this conversation. Well, how do you like your tea? I like my tea with skim milk, one sugar, and not too strong. And then the other people you'd have it all different. And that's what building a team is. And that's what I failed to do. And I pray for Sam, because I actually signed him from Millwall for a free transfer to Cumbria City, and he did a great job for me as a footballer. And I just wish and hope that Sam can learn from some of my experiences of where I went wrong.
Well, the thing is, Bobby, no one can say you didn't do your best to improve morale, although it seemed at the time you were fighting a battle you couldn't win, namely the dressing room.
But I think the players believe that. You know, I can look back now and you know, like my first appointment when I left with Mark Hughes and Neville Southall to go in, I appointed Gary Speed as a captain. He went on to become manager, sadly lost, and then Chrissy Coleman, look what a wonderful job he's done. And somewhere along the line, they would have taken some good parts of me and you know, and they've looked at the bad parts and said, no, I don't want to do that. And that's where Chrissy Coleman and Wales have been so successful. And the players that they've got now, they're now, you know, they can lead on again, they can kick on again, and hopefully they can qualify for a World Cup, which would be wonderful for the Welsh people.
Bobby, September 1998, Robbie Savage, Maldini's shirt. Tell our listeners what happened.
I was going for a run at a hotel in just outside Wrexham. I was going for a run and I was up at 6 o'clock. Went for my run, keep my weight down and everything else. Came back. My number two, Graham Williams, knocked on my door and he said, have you seen the Sky Sports News? I said, no, I've been out running. So I was in a position of going along to Robbie Savage's room and saying, have you seen what I've seen on Sky Sports News? He says, no. I says, well, you better watch it. So he watched it an hour later as they repeat them. He came down. I says, I want you to leave this squad immediately. I said, what you did to that Maldini shirt is disgraceful. What he actually did was, there was a Cub reporter working for Sky, and the Cub reporter had got a tatty old blue shirt with a number 3 on the back. They gave it to Robbie Savage, and then he threw it in a waste paper bin. And I took umbrage, big umbrage to that, because I thought it was disrespectful to one of the great left-backs that the world had ever seen, really. And I said to Robbie, I don't want you in my squad. I said, pack your case, pack your bags, and disappear home. Well, later on in the afternoon, there'd been a lot of discussions, and Ryan Giggs, Mark Hughes, Neville Southall, they all came to me and they said, look, we understand we realise what you've done and why you've done it, but we'd like Robbie back in the squad. I says, is that a majority vote or what? He says, yeah, it's a majority, 100%. I says, well, you can have him back. I says, but he won't start the game tomorrow. And it was just my way of, my disciplines, of my respect of the game, of what's given me a wonderful living and everything else that goes with it. And if Robbie and I now, we're great mates, we're good mates. He understood what the lesson I was trying to show, and not only to Robbie, but to the world of football, that you must respect your fellow opposition, whether they've won, lost or drawn. And that's the beauty of football. And it's given me a wonderful living. And I wouldn't change anything. And I know from my heart, Robbie Savage has learnt a great deal from that episode as well.
Excellent. Last season, Bobby, you know, the rise and success of Jamie Vardy has been a huge talking point. Indeed, some have claimed that his meteoric rise from non-league to league title winner and an England player could be made into a Hollywood film. But plucking a player from non-league is nothing new. And it could be argued that your experience actually trumps the Vardy story. Tell us about the trip you took to Wealdstone Town and how you unearthed the future England captain.
There was a lad called Brian Eastig, who was a coach at Chelsea with Jeff Hurst, and I took him as a youth team coach to Coventry City when he was out of work. And I said, I'm looking for a left back. He says, I've got one for you. He said, Stuart Pearce, Wealdstone. So I was managing Coventry at the time. I phoned up my wife. I says, oh, I'll take you out for dinner. She says, where are we going? I says, Yeovil. Oh, she says, they've got a nice restaurant down there. I says, I think so. So I drove from Coventry to Portishead, picked Marge up, took her down to Yeovil, and they put me on the front seat. It was a big slope on the pitch then, and there was this left back that was playing in front of me on the left hand side in a green and white in a shirt, and against the green shirts of Yeovil. And all of a sudden, this left back, he tackles this wide right player, and I've never seen a tackle like it. And the winger virtually landed in my lap, and I looked at my wife. I says, I've seen enough. She says, is only 5 minutes gone? I says, I've got to go now. I says, I've seen all I want to see. She says, no, you can't be rude. Anyway, so we sat down, got to half-time, and anyway, we disappeared at half-time, and I went back, I said, Boss Dick, I said, you're a great judge, and I went and bought Stuart Pearce for £22,500.
Wow.
Incredible.
Wow. Absolutely incredible.
And he was something very special. Very, very special. Been released by Terry Venables and QPR, and his left foot was sweet and everything else. It was all you could wish for in, as a modern, you know, a modern day left fullback in those days.
Absolutely. Well, Bobby, your grandson Matt has followed in his father's footsteps by playing in goal as opposed to up front like his granddad. He's only 22, which is very young for a goalkeeper. So how far do you think he can go in the game?
I think you've got to look at circumstances of life. You know, you go back over small goalkeepers, like there was Peter Bonetti, and it was like, it was great reactions and everything. You know, I remember Gordon Banks, you know, and you look at these people, and they were never all 6 foot four or great bodies and everything. I mean, and sometimes you need an agile goalkeeper, you know, and that's how I see Matthew at the moment. He's been wonderfully coached by his father, who knows the ups and downs of being successful as a goalkeeper and having great careers at Celtic and going on to play for Scotland. But Matthew's got to become himself. You know, Wayne Rooney's got to become himself, you know. And as you're coming through the ranks, you have to look at yourself and say, that's my strength. This is my ability. Am I a six-yard box? Or my person, am I good with the ball? Can I distribute the ball? And these are all the things that the modern-day keeper has to look at. But people are looking around at, you know, six-foot-four people and how big they are and what big presence they are within the goal. But if you've got somebody that you believe in, then you've got to go with it. And, you know, I think Matthew's, he's got a great attitude. Whether he makes it or not, we don't know. We just don't know. But I know one thing, it won't be for the want to try.
Fantastic. Brilliant.
Bobby, it's been great talking to you. Before we finish, three quick-fire questions. First one, favourite player you managed and why?
Trevor Peake. Took him from Lincoln City and was so reliable as a centre-half. You'd want him in your team every game. You know you were going to get a great performance from him. Trevor Peake, and never, ever once give me a problem by coming into the manager's office.
Wow. Best football memory?
Best football memory?
Yeah.
Scoring at Wembley, I'll never forget that.
Excellent. And your happiest time in football?
My happiest time in football? What a question. My happiest time in football? Becoming a better player at 28 years of age at West Ham and understanding what one-touch football was and how to play it. And that was an education for me. And at 28, I realised if I had gone there as a 21-year-old, I would have played for England. I have no shadow of that. Because I've got determination, I've got everything in, I ticked every tick in the box other than controlling the ball. Because the great Bill Shankly said of me once at Anfield, where Liverpool had drawn 2-2 with West Ham, and West Ham had a semi forward that couldn't trap a bag of cement. Well, I got news for Shank, so I can trap a bag of cement with both feet now.
Brilliant. Bobby, thank you from myself. It was fantastic talking to you.
Great pleasure.
Bobby, thank you ever so much for agreeing to appear on the show. Your appearance has been very much appreciated. In the meantime, do you remember your Twitter handle so our listeners can interact with you a bit?
Yeah, is that the Goldfather?
Yeah, the Goldfather, there you go.
There you go.
Fantastic. Well, Bobby, thank you ever so much for your time, sir.
Okay, thanks ever so much, lads. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Bobby. Cheers. So that, ladies and gents, was Bobby Gould. No doubt one of the most entertaining guests we've ever had on the show. Now, we only scratched the surface when questioning Bobby's career. Let's not forget, he was a pro for 16 years, then a manager for 31 years. That's 47 years in the game. Some don't even last 47 days, let alone 47 years. I'd like to thank Bobby for his honesty and look forward to having him back on the show at some point. And before I wrap this up, just a few quick plugs. Visit our sponsors' websites, fnx.network and mysportswear.co.uk. Give them a follow on Twitter at fnxnetwork and at mysportswear1. iOS users, that's Apple for those who don't know, subscribe to our show on iTunes, please. Give us a rating and leave a comment. It will really help give us some more exposure. And on a final note, follow us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence, and visit our website shootthedefence.com. Shoot the Defence, we're here.